Bob McCarthy is our keynote speaker, and I'm really pleased to be able to introduce him to do this talk, and I was really pleased that he was able to do so. The thing about a keynote is we don't really need to introduce them because they're so well known, which is great because I've forgotten his notes anyway, so that's all right. But Bob has been doing what he's been doing for quite a few years now, and I think anybody who stands up and is prepared to talk to audio engineers how to do their job, A, is either a masochist or has got a large ego. I'm not going to say which. But then when you write a book about it and tell them how to do it, that's really taking it to the next stage. And have you got book number two coming out, do I hear? Or a revision of the first one?
Third edition.
Okay. And that's been out for how long?
Third edition's not out yet. It'll be out in November.
No, but how long's when?
The first edition was 2007.
Right.
And that was after the previous book was 1997.
Okay, so it's been around a while.
1994 and...
and whatever.
I'm a one-note wonder. I keep writing the same book.
Well, you get it right one day.
Exactly.
Okay, anyway, without any further ado, I'd like to ask Bob to give the keynote lecture, which is on sound system optimization, past, present, and future. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate your having me here. Thank you, Peter. Thank you to everyone. That's really the first thing that I have to say. Thanks to the AES for hosting this great idea to have a strictly live sound conference. To Wieslaw, and I think I got his name spelled right. Peter Mapp, George Massenburg, Admire Sound, Gavin Kanan, all the people that helped me to be here, and Mom, of course. But what we're going to talk about is basically sound system optimization, the tuning of sound systems, and how we used to do it in the past, and what led up to how we do it, and just some musings and thoughts on the future. The first thing to take a look at and consider is the signal path of the past, the present, and the future. You look back at the ancient times, and the path is, of course, from analog to analog, human voice to human hearing. And as time has gone on, we've inserted things in the path, such as analog electronics, microphones, and speakers. And then we started to go into the digital world, inserting little pieces to digital, such as the delay lines of the 1980s. And more market share has gone over to the digital world. And now, at this point, we're approaching to the point where the digital networking world will hold the entire signal chain pretty much from acoustic to acoustic. And that's your future. It's pretty close to now, right now, but that's certainly, you can see, every bit that of market share that analog has given up to digital, it's never given back. Just don't have that argument with some vinyl head. That's the only thing I would suggest. Okay. It's funny how you don't have anybody that's really in love with cassette tapes. But the vinyl, yeah. Okay. So what is sound system optimization? Okay. Well, is it setting of crossovers? Well, that's one of the things it is. Is it aiming the speakers? Yeah. Is it splaying the speakers, getting the right angle between them, or getting the right spacing between them? Is it setting EQ, level, and delay? Those are the things that we set on our signal processors. The other things that you saw up there are somewhat physical and or perhaps electronic as well. And then, to some extent, acoustic modification. Although in very, very few cases do we get to say, you know, this room stinks, can we tear it down before we have the concert? Although that would be merited in many cases. But so that tends to be a very short subject for us. Maybe we get some fiberglass or some curtains or these kind of things. But generally speaking, these other things are the main pieces of the puzzle for us, our main tools and techniques. So other things that people think sound system optimization is, one of them is they think we're the EQ police. We're going to come in and we're going to make your system, you must be flat. You will be flat under all circumstances. I will force that, my analyzer is there. And it's like crazy talk, because really I have no interest in being your policeman, okay? Like, I have a very simple philosophy. It's like, you make the garbage, I spread the garbage, okay? I'm just going to make sure it gets spread evenly. That's all I care about. I'm not interested in debating your art with you, okay? It's really just manure spreading. Sometimes it smells really good. But that's a big piece of it, is that we're not here to tone your system, we're here to tune your system, and there's a big difference, okay? Tuning a piano doesn't make it play Mozart. That's a whole other story, okay? So is it a threat to the SPL Preservation Society? Oh, boy. Oh, no, you're turning two of my speakers down out of 100 speakers. You've sapped all the bodily fluids out of it. This is a major concern with people. And no, I'm not here to do that either. What I'm here is to then, again, spread the sound uniformly and evenly. And if it's too loud in front, then, one of the options just might be turn the speakers that are covering the front down a couple dB. Yeah, isn't it all about making it sound good at the mix position? No, the mix position is a self-calibrating. It's self-optimizing because it's in a servo loop. You got your hands on the faders. You don't like the way it sounds. You modify the sound. There's nothing objective about that. That's a loop, okay? So you don't need our help for that. Your job is to make it sound good at the mix position. We spread it, okay? Or is it the search for the unicornic free pass filters? Okay? Everybody wants these mythical features, these mythical filters out there that are going to be the, oh man, this one filter I put in and it didn't have any phase shift and that made it sound great in every seat. Oh, really? Here, stupid me thought it was the aiming the speakers the right way, setting the levels and the display angles and the spacing and EQing different parts of the room in different ways because they are in very different rooms in a lot of ways. I had these naive ideas of that. Okay. Okay. So basically, let's look at what the goals of optimization are. Well, number one is maximum uniformity. I think I've been pretty clear on that. But let's just start with maximum uniformity of level. Let's go with maximum uniformity of spectrum. Everybody gets the same spectral picture. How about maximum uniformity of clarity or intelligibility or signal-to-noise ratio? Or how about maximum uniformity of sonic image? We all like everybody to think that the sound is coming from the general area of the stage and not from overhead for the people in the front and these kind of things. That's why we pay for the front fills and things like that. Maximum SPL capability. No, we're not here to take away your power. We are here to make everybody in phase. That's a nice way of getting the maximum out of your systems. Okay? And then minimum phase variance, keeping the disparity of time and phase between parts of your system at an absolute minimum, and to have the minimum latency to get us as close in time to the events on stage as possible. That's kind of a nice little simplified set of goals. Okay? What are some of the challenges? Well, location, 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 that's what they say in real estate. That's what we say in optimization. Location number one, that's the room itself. That's that's a real obstacle if it's a bad room. Or location, as in they put the speakers in a bad location. We know this one very well. The speakers pushed completely way off to the sides. Location. A third one is bad locations for the audience, such as 90 feet deep, under a 8-foot tall under balcony. Okay, so these are the challenges we face, and those are the biggest ones. Holy God. Coverage subdivision is another form of a challenge that we have to take into our approach for system optimization, and that is dividing up the system into parts. In the world of acousticians, they think of, and you guys were all just at the symphony hall, right? And the symphony hall mindset is of this unitary single vessel of sound. And they're looking at the first arrival a direct sound, and they're like sleeping while the direct sound is happening. It's like, oh, it hit a wall. Now it's time to wake up. That's when you get an acoustician interested, okay? And there now they start to plan out all the bazillions of paths to make this great super single volume of reverberation. We look at it a totally different way. We say, we got to cover the direct sound to get you from speaker to ears. And after it starts hitting walls, we just go, oh God, I hope it doesn't go badly. Okay, there's nothing good that can come from those walls. They're just not our friends. We just have to put up with them, okay? But we don't sit and go, oh man, I was having real trouble until I got this reflection off this wall and that fixed the sound here. That's pretty unlikely to be the solution to your speaker problem, okay? So we subdivide our systems to get them to fit and make the shapes to fill the room uniformly, because speakers make shapes. They have these certain natural shapes that they make, and we use those shapes to fill that vessel and lay that carpet down of direct sound. If I wanted to cover this room, I'd need to lay something that goes deep, and then like a diagonal line, whoop, comes down to the front. It's almost a hatchet shape. Okay? Now, a single speaker is not real inclined to make that hatchet shape, so we can use an array of speakers that is more bendable. And then we want to make its horizontal shape so that it doesn't pick up too much help from the walls. Crossover management. What is that? Well, everybody knows what crossover is, the highs to the lows at 1K or the subwoofers to your low mid cabinet, but it also means the transition from your mains to your under balconies, or from your side fills to your mains, or your front fills to your mains. Anytime you are combining things acoustically, that's a crossover. And the same rules are going to apply. The same thing that we do with a crossover at 1K, we say, well, you guys are going to share 1K, you better be in phase. Well, we're going to do the same thing if they're going to share that seat. The third row is where the front fills are going to meet the mains coming down. We better make sure you guys are in phase there. Better make sure you're in phase under the balcony. That's what you're doing with an under balcony delay. You're phase aligning the under balcony speakers to the mains that are coming under there. So we've got to manage those transitions, and that's a key part of optimization, is crossover management. Now, these are some of the things that are up against us in a mental sense. Number one is design factor 1900. Does anybody know what that is? No, because I just made that up last week. What does it mean? It means rooms that are designed right here and now as if we're still in the year 1900. Because there's a lot of acoustical people out there who are still in the year 1900 or earlier, who think that we need all these, you know, near reflections in order to whatever, in order to pretend that we aren't speakers, because we're speakers. Sorry, we're not violinists. We're not 100 musicians on the stage. We're a left stack and a right stack. It's very different if my left and right stack get a hard wall reflection that puts a comb filter signature on every single instrument in the PA. That's not what it does to a set of violins spread across the stage. It's a totally different thing. That's a friendly, helping combing for them. It's not nice for us. We know this. A lot of other people don't seem to have gotten the message and are still building rooms with design factor 1900. Design factor 1960. That's when we get at least up to where we recognize that speakers exist, but oh, we don't want to see them. Okay? Right? I mean, how many times have we been through this where everybody has to hide all the speakers? Lighting instruments sitting out there, you know, making smoke and making noise and having little lights leaking out of them. Oh, yeah, that's all perfectly fine. But a black speaker doing nothing, that's an abomination. How can we possibly have this in my view? So sound is very important, but it's not that important. So off it goes, off into soffits, off into strange places, way up into the hinterlands up there. And of course, puts us in terrible positions, terrible imaging, terrible coverage, early reflections. Always they tell us, oh yeah, the soffits, no problem. We won't put any structural steel in front of you or your speakers. Oh yeah, okay, no problem. I can still hear it. Then there's design factor 2525. But that's the future, you know the old song. Okay? That's that designer who, to quote my old friend Andrew Hope, who's here today, the guy who's just not quite sure the best shape for a wheel is round. Okay? They've got to go and have this newest thing, and they're going to fill their hall up with glass and steel and all sorts of bizarro shapes and not naming names, Frank Gehry. And, you know, it's like, what, you know? It's just amazing. So these are the challenges that are in front of us. Okay. So other things about optimization are some of the dummy kind of checks that we have to do before we go and get to do the glorious stuff of setting EQ and all that kind of stuff that we live for. Well, you got to make sure that the speakers are the correct speakers, that left is left and right is right, and uppers is uppers and lowers are lowers. You got to make sure the polarity is correct. You got to make sure your latency doesn't have any nice surprises, and that is, of course, getting to be a bigger and bigger issue at every system every day is all the crackerjack latency. What's crackerjack latency? Surprise in every box. Okay. Then we've got to analyze our headroom to make sure that we've got, you know, that we're not squeezing the system down somewhere, losing headroom at some squeeze point in the system. Stupidity removal, okay, that's a major factor. Just like crazy stuff like gigantic set pieces blocking speakers, under balcony areas that have no visible speakers to them, all of these kind of things. And I've already talked about acoustical modification. Okay. What was system optimization? And this is where it's kind of like this term, system optimization, is really a pretty new term. And it wasn't called that before. It was called things like that. And it was really, called system EQ or system equalization or system tuning. But I remember really getting, as I pushed this thing forward, was part of that wave in the 80s, and we're starting to develop with these analyzers the ability to do more work than just EQ, that I really resisted the idea of someone saying that all you're doing is EQing the system. Because if all it was left and right mains, and that's all we did, then it was just EQ. And really, all that was now a tug-of-war between the EQ that the mixer wanted and the EQ that you put on, which is where this whole EQ police comes from, okay? But when you get to where now you're going to start to rearrange the splay angles in the PA, you're going to rearrange the relative levels, you're going to retime things, you're going to find broken speakers and find reverse polarity, and all these things are going to be done, now you're doing much more than equalization. And I remember having a discussion with Jamie. Jamie's here, right? Jamie's not here. Jamie's here. Okay. Now my recollection is it wasn't about when you were there that we came up and said we had sim equalization services and we ended up coming up with the decision to change it to optimization. That's where we started to use that term. Is that you? Would you back me up on that?
Yeah, that was part of my thesis.
Oh, okay. There you go. So it was, you know, so probably we're talking what year, like 1989, 1990 maybe? 92. Okay. So we've been doing this work, but it's been evolving. And I got so tired of people saying, well, let me hear it with SIM and without SIM. And they'd want to just go over to the parametric EQ and pop the buttons out. Meanwhile, I had found 3 blown drivers. I had resplayed the thing. I had re-aimed the thing. I had phase-aligned an ABC type array with mains, middles, and downfills to get all of these transitions to happen. And all of this stuff had happened, and I've got the side fills at a lower level. I was like, you want to do an AB, okay? You're going to have your fingers there. I'm going to have 3 guys reversing drivers, unplugging high drivers. I'm going to have them resplay the angles, and then we'll talk. Because there's much more to it than just a fight over whose EQ setting is right, the robot, that's me, or the artist, that's the other guy. It's like, oh, please don't get into the lab coats versus berets thing. I'm here to help, okay? I really don't have an agenda. Okay? Okay, I've lost you. Okay, so now we're going to go on the Wayback Machine with Mr. Peabody, okay? And let's look here, A Brief History of Time. Somebody else had came up with that title, I think. So I added in phase and coherence and stuff. Okay? So you probably recognize this thing. So I'm going to check on its properties panel. Okay, yeah, universe, author unknown. There's a lot of dispute on this, especially in the U.S., I'll tell you. Oh, wow. Okay. The operating system is physics 1.0. There is no update planned in our lifetime. So what's really nice, I always emphasize to my students, anything you learn about physics is going to outlive you. So go ahead and do it. Okay, so we're going to go with intelligent sound design. In the beginning, there was silence. Then there was a really big bang. And the people said, how can I make that louder? Okay? Okay, that's Luke Jenks' line, so I want to have that known. So here we go then. Okay? Whoops, I missed one. Oh, yeah, no. And tuning fork begat Helmholtz, who begat phonautograph, who begat manometric flame, who begat Phonodyke, who begat oscillograph, who begat sine wave sweep, who begat oscilloscope, who ran off with the harlot and begat the RTA. And Fourier begat FFT, and Teff had a daughter, Melissa. FFT begat twins, transfer, and function. And begat SIM1, SIM2, who begat SMART, and SysTune, and SatLive, and SpectraFoo, and Wave Capture, and SIM3, and iPhone app now, and many, many more. So that's sort of your basic genealogy. So we have these frequency analyzers. Well, we got it easy, because somebody else had to figure out frequency. And that's where the tuning forks came in. You can go see these at the Smithsonian. But that's really where these things were done originally. We have to figure out what is frequency. You can get precision frequency with a clock fork, which is synchronized to a clock and could get frequency down to 0.001 hertz, which was impressive at that time. We know we can do better, right? Helmholtz resonators. Also known as a beer bottle. Then here's the phonautograph. The reason why you don't know the name Koenig is that his version of the phonograph, the sound went down onto a wheel and wrote it with a pencil. So it made the waveform, but you couldn't play it back. So he was so close. So close. Okay. That's the phone autograph. This is a cool one. This is, you take a big black piece of cloth and a white string and take a time-lapse photograph, and you can see the waveform. Luckily, we can do it a little bit easier, but it just helps you appreciate this. Now, this one, I don't suggest you do this at home, the manometric flame. You have to have a Bunsen burner and a flame source and a rotating mirror, and you can get waveforms such as this. And this is how you're now able to start to see an actual musical waveform or the voice. And they're learning in this process now how to analyze the waveform. The Phonodyke was a less flammable version of the same, again, with the rotating optics that would project onto a screen. And here you can see the words PRE, prepped, or whatever, preparatory, I don't know what the word is. Pardon me?
Preparative.
Ooh, it doesn't sound good. Okay, so we break into the electronic era with the oscillograph, which is huge because now we can analyze an electronic waveform. And of course, that's going to really set the stage for the birth of our industry, which is our industry first and foremost is about the transportation of electronic waveforms. And here's a really cool version of a typical lab nowadays. No. And this is Wallace Sabine's work, who used a spark source to be able to, they fill a room with smoke, this tiny little 1/10 scale room, and then he could see the spark source create waves through the spark, through the gas there, and photographed it. And so think about that when you do your next press predict on your next prediction program, how much Wallace Sabine would rather be in your shoes. As far as excitation sources, the sine wave sweep, early way to go, and you would work with an oscilloscope and a sine wave sweep, and you could watch the waveform go by, it grow or shrink or these things. Now, to give you just a little perspective, for those of you old enough to know a speaker called the UPA, which is about this big, a 12 and a horn, it's a well-known speaker. That speaker was developed in 79 at Meyer Sound Labs on these two tools, sine wave and an oscilloscope. And that speaker was phase-aligned through crossover. John was able to get it on the right cycle, which is a real hard thing to do with a sine wave and an oscilloscope. and that convinced him to, as soon as they could afford it, to buy an FFT. This is an RTA. first commercial one that was out there much was made by Hewlett-Packard. I saw this tuning the Grateful Dead's PA system in, probably about 1976. The real-time analyzer is a device that doesn't have time. It's basically, it gives you a amplitude-only rendering of the response, which is, of course, really nice and convenient. It's a wonderful version, Dave Gunnis's slide said, a simple answer to a complex question. And I think, what did you say? Simple is sometimes, whatever, it was like, you can either be simple or accurate, and there you go. So then it became really commercially available and handheld in the IV-30, and every sound man ran around with this thing, and it ruined sound system tuning. I'll just tell you that, it set us back 10 years. And the reason is that everybody tried this thing, and everybody then concluded, wow, analyzers, what a stupid idea. Because they tune systems with them, and the systems sound, they tune literally to the flat police official setting, and everybody flipped out and said, holy God, that's the dumbest thing to do in the world. And so it led to this whole pushback of analyzers, we don't need no stinking analyzers. And when we developed the FFT out into the market, we had a tremendous amount of resistance in the industry to bringing a tool out there, because I've already tried the screwdriver, doesn't work, right? I'll just keep using my hands or whatever. It's like, wow, okay? TEF was another player in the industry that is it's an FFT-based system, as much as some people didn't like to acknowledge the FFT in there. But it was in there, and it's basically developed by Richard Heiser, originally as time delay spectrometry, and was able to get a simulated anechoic response in a room, which was really exciting because you could see the response as if there was no walls in the room. So you could do a lot of research, acoustic research, that allowed you to do this without having a chamber. As far as a system tuning tool, there's like, if you look at all the things that we do in system tuning, which I named off you, the splay angles and the time setting, the level setting, all these things would have come out exactly the same whether you used a SIM, FFT, or SMART, or any of these FFT tools, or TEF. The only difference is going to be when it comes to the EQ, they are bringing in a different amount of the tonal window into the EQ. And this set off, wow, a huge, huge lot of years of excitement, and on we go. Now I'm going to bring you now to the point where I come into the game, and that is John Meyer takes the bench, the FFT off my bench, where I was the test technician for Meyer at the time, and takes it to the Rush concert and analyzes that show using the music as the source. That was the revolutionary moment here, was with the music playing and the music being received, you did what's called a transfer function measurement, and you say, wow, what's the difference between music sent and received? Now you can see the frequency response, you can see the phase response, you can see what it is that happened when the room was empty, what happened when the room was full. All of these things are now revealed. Some of the great mysteries of sound are right there on our screen. I would love to say that I was involved in the SIM program from day one, but I wasn't. This show was Saturday night. I didn't get involved until Monday morning. What I was doing on that Saturday night was on my back porch making the prototype of the CP10 parametric on a parallel operation, and those two things came together because one of the first things that we found from analyzing these shows was that the graphic EQ was a very poor tool for the job because it had fixed center frequencies and fixed bandwidth for a set of problems that don't have such tendencies. They have unfixed center frequencies and unfixed bandwidths. So we needed a tool that could create the countermeasure to what the system, the speaker-speaker interaction and the speaker-room interaction were doing, and that was the parametric EQ. And the parametric EQ was pretty much not accepted as a tool at that time. It was kind of on the marginal edge, and this is going to be the start of pushing it into the mainstream. This is the FFT analyzer, and FFT stands for Fast Fourier Transform. The fast doesn't mean that, well, this is 1976 was when this was first manufactured, so it would be a slow Fourier transform. But really what the fast means is not infinity, because the real Fourier theorem is an infinite equation. We've got a show at 7, so we can't wait. So we have to use the fast Fourier transform, and that is it's a reduction based on some assumptions, basically being whatever I see right now happened since forever and will happen again forever. But this is the basic idea, and literally that's a bigger screen than what it was. It's this big, and that's what we were working with. And you would crank this frequency span select to see the linear frequency range of interest. It was like working a periscope. Okay, periscope has great focus, great depth, but a very limited range of view. So we would literally have to look at the lows. We'd see about 2 octaves at a time, and it took 7 different measurements to get a frequency response, a process that took at the very least a couple of minutes. Okay, and so we'd be looking around at 4 kilohertz and hoping nothing happened at 250K because it's out of your view right now, okay? And so if you look at this thing, you would see, well, pretty much what I just showed you in the periscope, so whoops, it's gone. So this now comes down to this mentality of the transfer function, which is looking at the difference between things, and we basically boil this thing down into 3 usable transfer functions. The one is the speaker system itself in the room. The other is the equalizer itself. And the third is the combination of them. We called it room EQ result. So you're going to find what you got as the problem, your peaks and your dips. You're going to find them there in the room. You're going to make the inverse in the EQ, and then you're going to prove that you did it here. So how does that work? Well, here's our musical source, and then our unknown speaker and our unknown EQ. Well, we take this electrical signal. That's what shows up. Uh-oh, look what showed up on the acoustical. It's got a peak. Okay, when you transfer those things out, that's what shows up, is just the difference is the peak. So now we know what the speaker is. So now we know our target is to make the inverse of that on the EQ. So I now move my probe points to the input and the output of the EQ, and I'm going to turn the knobs until they make that picture. And then, I know Mom always told me, 2 wrongs don't make a right, but here you go, I've proved her wrong again, okay? Because I'm going to put this dip in, then the speakers are going to add their peak, and together, we're going to get it like that. And that's the basic principle of the 3 transfer functions that is still present in the capability of these analyzers. 31 years later. Okay? So this is a picture now of those the very first concerts we ever did, literally with a chart recorder, and it took 21 operations to get these three, because each one of them is seven, and I literally cut and paste them to get them together to make one frequency response. So that little picture that comes up on your smart screen, bing, it's like, we used to walk to school 6 miles uphill, both ways. Okay, but so this was the thing is, there was the peaks and we did these dips and that's your story. Okay, so here we are. This was taken last year. And there's the HP3582. It was literally, to get us a feed at this show, they spliced open the cable at the back of the console and stuck on gator clips onto it into my unbalanced banana plugs here. Kids, don't try this at home. We had the mic preamp for the Brulin Care measurement mic. A frequency counter. What would you have a frequency counter for? Well, it was an analog delay line. And the analog delay line, we would look at it through the frequency counter as we turn the knob, and then all you got to do to know your time in milliseconds was divide that number by 132,680. It's a very, very catchy user interface. I believe it's still the standard. I mean, you guys use it, right, Jamie? Yeah, okay. And these were the CB10 prototypes hand-built by yours truly, the white third octaves, which are in a duel for their lives. They would not last the day. And, of course, my Marie Osmond tour T-shirt from Shoko. I loved wearing that at Dead shows. The Deadheads would look at me like, what, man? I shouldn't have taken so much. Okay, so that's your basic, I call it primordial sim. Okay, here's how we would set delays, because you didn't have an impulse response. It's like you guys got GPS. Well, we got a transit, okay? And so you would look at the phase wraparounds, and you'd have to know what span you're on, and then divide. If you're in the 250 hertz span, you know that each wraparound means 4 milliseconds, and so you would go and find your way that way, working your way to try to sort it out. And so here you see a picture. This is 4 milliseconds, which is one wrap from the 0 to 250 hertz band. It's two wraps if you're looking at the 0 to 500, and four wraps if it's 0 to 1K, because all the spans start at 0. That's the beauty of the linear scale. Beauty, huh? Okay? So this is how we would do this. And in those days, speakers, oh my God, if you found it at 1K, that didn't mean you found it at 10K or at 200. The speakers were, shall we say, very creative about their temporal distribution. Okay, we presented this paper now to the AES, and we were very excited. Went to the AES in New York and showed them equalization using music and voice as the source. And the abstract, a source-independent technique to measure accurately the amplitude and phase of sound systems. Measurements may be made during live performances, with music as the test signal. Correlation is shown between impulse response and music signals. Equalizer, which corrects for many room resonances in both amplitude and phase simultaneously, has been developed, and this is demonstrated on conscious systems. And then we went and did a workshop, and we showed with this peak and dip created by a boundary at the speaker, and then we put in this dip and peak with the EQ with its own complementary phase, and we flattened out and improved both the amplitude and phase, and we felt pretty darn good about that. And the AES said, eh. So if you're looking for this paper in your ancient, going back through your things, you won't find it. It was never printed. That's it, preprint. That's the last time. Because they objected to our statement that room resonances could be countered. Or someone objected to it. Oh. It was Don Davis. He said it. Yes, we were. Yes, we were. So, there you go. It was I told you about the TEF versus the FFT and the SIM thing, and this is where it brimmed over. And on we went. We said, okay, on we go. Now, the typical system in that time had this level of complexity. EQ left, EQ right, speaker left, speaker right. That's a small system. What's a big system complexity? Well, it's EQ left, EQ right, and 100 speakers left and 100 speakers right. But that's the mentality of a rock and roll system at that time. We've come a long way now. We have. But at that time, this was the strict rule. All must turn to 11. So, and here's a classic case. This is a Grateful Dead array at the time, and absolutely every speaker not only was on the same EQ, they were so concerned about uniformity, they had it through a single crossover processor. Even though you had infills, or those are outfills, and you had downfills, and you had a double long throw main, all of them were going through a single EQ. So there was really nothing to do in terms of optimization, because there was only the EQ setting was on the table, and so then it became back to the who's in charge here, is it my EQ or your EQ? And this pushed us away from the rock and roll world, and we went much more to the theatrical world. And that's where we really found acceptance, because the theatrical world was all about all this subdivision and about matrixing and about separate systems for voice and separate for music, and they were all about, not about level, they were not crazy about level, because they didn't have the moving lights they needed to be louder than in those days. So they were all about uniformity and about vocal intelligibility. So that brought us then into the world of there. Okay, so now, this problem with this stupid analyzer is it's only got two traces in memory. Remember, it takes 63 traces just to see a single response? So we had to bring in a computer, and let me tell you, look at what we got here. The HP 87, that's got as much computing power. Well, if there was 1,000 of these, it wouldn't be an Apple Watch. Okay? I mean, come on. Okay? 64K. Okay? But it could allow us to basically get a before set of responses. So you could do a hall empty, and then you could actually do a second set of an after. It's like, wow. So now we were finally able to take some data home and see what we had at the end of the day. So now we're ready to build our own analyzer and go into manufacturing. And this was our prototype, the SimCAD, and we sold one, I know Bob Snellgrove is here, yep. We sold it to the Jubilee Auditorium in Calgary, and then we had a big problem on our hands. We needed to make it. Because this thing is the HP analyzer and a bunch of buttons hooked up to a DC light supply. Okay, he's like, oh, that's a good thing to bring to the AS convention. Now what are we going to do? Okay, so we had a little time, so we managed to get it together. And I'm busy programming away in HP Basic. My friend Thorny called it spaghetti code, but it was all we had. And this was now the SIM System 1, 600 pounds. So when people say to me, when are you going to make the SIM system smaller? I said, we already did. Okay? Now, this is a multi-channel system. It could do 8 microphones, 8 EQs, and is Gary Hardesty here? I saw him on the list earlier. Did he make it? Nope. So Gary Hardesty's company made the delay line that we put in there. Audio Digital was the name of the company. and so it had a whole megabyte of RAM. That cost $1,100 extra. And this cool inkjet printer, which was great because it would work once. then the ink would dry and that would be the end of it. It's like, oh, you know, it's like, you can maybe get 5 pages out of it if you did them right away. But if it stopped, it's finished. Okay, and we're still unbalanced banana plugs. But that was it. But this was really great because we could put 8 microphones out all in the room and bring that data in, and we could actually store 8 times 2, we had 16 sets of traces we could put in memory. So now we're able to do a full set, a full room of before and after, and be able to start to build arrays and to see the interaction of how the A speaker meets the B speaker and all of these kind of things. Okay? Oh my God, I've used up all my time. So That brings us to, well, there's the SIM System 1 in action. So we went to Hewlett-Packard and we said, okay, build us an analyzer. And so we gave them the full spec. We need log frequency access. We need an impulse response, all these things. And here's what they came up with. It was really brilliant. They came up with their computer, and that's one, that's two, that's three. Uh-oh, you see where this is going now. Okay. Yes, 21 of them. We called it the semi-truck. Okay, so, I mean, what are you going to do with that? Okay, so it's like, well, you can buy an entire PA system or an analyzer for the PA system. Those are your choices. So we had to enter the business ourselves. And that's when we made SIM System 2. And SIM System 2 comes out in 1991. It was way ahead of its time. And it basically gave you the response that everybody knows and loves now. It's called the fixed point per octave response. It basically takes all of those multiple octaves with the ever longer time records as you go down in frequency and stitches them together with you not being able to see where the stitch marks are unless you know where to look. And there's your response, and bada boom. Now we've got our room response, we've got the inverted EQ response, and then we've got the result response, and that's your finished product there. So that became then the platform that has become the standard in the industry. And Smart comes along in 1995 and implements this same McClellan-Parks algorithm, which is the one that stitches together the multiple FFTs to make a fixed point FFT. And they were able to implement it onto the Intel chip. This was Sam Burko leading that introducing Smart, and that brings it to the mass market now, because it becomes affordable, and whereas the SIM platform was still $50,000, and so that has brought then, and with that, and I call them these the sons of SIM, have brought the FFT now to the place that it is as the standard tool for system optimization. Known around the world. And so this is kind of where it all came from. And basically, where does it go from here? There, you can't really speed up the FFT. You can't find 30 hertz without 30 milliseconds. You can't predict, oh yeah, you're going to grow up and be a long wavelength. Okay? And so we have to wait, and you have to take these long time records. And to get high resolution in the low frequencies, you're talking about, over a half a second time records. So so you can't do that. What can you do? You can run operations in parallel, and that's where the growth is. That's the difference between these things as they go along. We can do more operations in parallel. We can do now. Jamie, you're doing 8 microphones running at once now, right?
I've done 27
at once. Bada boom. Okay. So who can afford 27 mics? Okay, yes, exactly. So obviously the processing capability is now not the limiting factor. We can go parallel, we can look at multiple microphones at once, and now so what are you going to do with that? Of course, we have to find methodologies of what to do with that. That's what I've worked my whole life, is to try to get a set of methodologies that do this work in a repeatable way, to get repeatable results with repeatable milestones. But the other challenges we face for the future would include the digital world. The digital world is as it takes over and has all of the non-acoustic custody. We've got to figure out how to be able to find that guy with all of his little paths and his jitter and any latencies or any hiccups or these kind of things. So that's going to be a challenge for the next generation of these analyzers. So basically, it's a kind of a funny thing, but people say, well, were systems simpler in the old days? In some ways they were, But in a lot of ways, the complexity of systems has risen with the complexity of our ability to optimize and manage them. Because there's nothing worse than a gigantically complex system that's not optimized. That's just a pile of spaghetti. But for example, the Beatles Love Show in Las Vegas, which some of you may have heard, has 6,600 speakers in the room and 288 channels of signal processing. And we measured that system over 7 nights and optimized that to make all of the pieces of the system work their parts of the room in the way that would allow Jonathan Deans, the designer, to artistically create the soundscape that he wanted with parts overlapping and parts non-overlapping and these kind of things. But you can get to that level of complexity when you know how to take and deconstruct the spaghetti so that you can put it back together in. And if I had the ability to do more parallel operations, that job could have been done all even faster. That's sort of the way I see the thing going. We've got a less and less analog. We've got to be able to, we're going to be in the network, so your analyzers are going to be needing to read all of the network and all of the audio in unconverted form, be able to talk digital. But eventually, you still got an analog world. Nobody gets to be immune to understanding analog because acoustic is stuck with analog. Especially the actors in theater, they're all still staying analog. The union has been real clear on this. I think that's all the time I have. Does anybody want to throw up any thoughts or questions before they kick me off the stage? Am I correct in my time? I got another 5 minutes. Okay, my thing. Okay, all right. I'll take them. What do we got here? Okay. So, I've already done that. Okay, here's a picture of Smart. Jamie will appreciate that. Okay, let's look at optimization in one sentence. This is like the really down to the thing. Optimization is the fulfillment of the prophecy. Whoa, that sounds really weird, but think about it. You go and you design a system, you're predicting the response. It's the optimization that's going to prove whether your prophecy or your prediction is correct or not. That's the place where we finally find out where the truth lies. Optimization is the proving ground. And that informs it's a loop, it informs the design process, because there's nothing that tells me how to design better like having an optimization fail. It's like, oh boy, I'll never design that into a system again. Everything that I learned in systems about designing comes from the successes and failures in optimization. The goals, in one sentence, we've already gone through those, uniformity and all those things. But the tools, the FFT analyzer, measurement mics, peripheral stuff, and of course, most importantly, your brains. Okay?
The person. Well.
Pardon me? Well, it's part of your head, isn't it?
Peripheral stuff.
It's part. If your ears are not connected to your brain, then they don't help. There's two basic perspectives: tuning and toning. Toning is that part where you're going to decide if you want that house curve, you want that tilt or that bend, or if you're a 2K fanatic. And that's your thing. I'm just going to make sure that it gets all over the place. The tuning is the objective part. The toning is the subjective part. There's no wrong toning. That's just you just got to explain it to the band manager. Two basic parts of optimization are verification and calibration. Verification is all that dummy stuff, like, are the speakers wired right? Are they functional? Is there an I-beam in front of them? Calibration is all the glamorous stuff, the EQ setting, the level setting, all the digital stuff, all of the finding the right splay angle and these kind of cool stuff. The operations, continuity, linearity, polarity, distortion check, latency checking, crosstalk checking, and looking out for magic. What do I call that? I don't like magic in systems. When something says, hey, wow, that's breaking the laws of physics, it's like, hold on, reel this back in and let's find out. Because even if it seems to be a really too good to be true, it's like, no, 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 don't want it, because that means it's too bad to be true somewhere else. So, because it's all going to equal out. So find any magic in your system and get it out. Okay? So aim, splay, space, crossover, level, time, and EQ, those are the basic operations. Subdivision, we divide things channel by channel. That would be left side fill works with the left mains. The vocal system goes with the vocals. L, C, and R are channels, that kind of a thing. The domains, spectral domain and spatial domain. There's the spectral domain, which is my system tilted or whatever. And spectral domain is, oh, I'm sorry, that was spectral. And spatial domain is my distribution equal over the space. And then it all boils down to this wonderful little equation. This is the equation that I tune all my systems by. A plus B equals A. And that would be the main plus the downfill. A plus B, they combine to the system. Now they're the main system. A plus B combines A, they're the new A, combines with this front fill. That's A plus B equals the new A. Ah, you got under balcony delays. A, which is the mains and the front fills, now join to them. And on it goes like that. Oh, you got subwoofers. A is the main, subwoofers is the B. And that's your equation. And you'll go through your whole system, build up yourself up bit by bit by bit by bit by bit by bit until you've got 6,600 speakers all tuned in. So thank you for having me. Thank you, Peter. And I hope that you enjoyed that time in the Wayback Machine and like that.
Thank you very much.